from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on this morning's Next Forum Hour, when Viet Thanh Nguyen sat down to write The Sympathizer, his debut novel about a Vietnamese spy who flees wartime Saigon, Nguyen channeled his own experience as an immigrant, and he says exploring that feeling between two worlds was central to his writing process. The book was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction in April, and he'll join us in studio to talk about winning literature's top national prize, his life as a refugee, and the role that the themes of marginalization and resistance play in his work. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this hour of the Forum program. Viet Thanh Nguyen joins us in studio for this Forum Hour, a recently announced winner of the Pulitzer Prize for his novel The Sympathizer. He was born in Vietnam and grew up here in San Jose, and he now lives in Los Angeles, teaches English and American Studies at University of Southern California. His highly praised debut novel is told from the point of view of a Vietnamese communist sympathizer living in the United States following the war in Vietnam. He's also the author of a couple of academic books, Race and Resistance, and Nothing Ever Dies. And we welcome him to the Forum program. Actually, welcome back. Last time you were here, we were talking about Vietnam, and you were on the phone with us.
It's great to be back here and in person.
Good to have you in person. And I ought to say that, first of all, congratulations on the Pulitzer.
Thank
you. This is a wonderful honor. And they praised, I should get this on the record, your book as being a layered immigrant tale told in a wry confessional voice of a man of two-minded, two countries, and actually it's a pretty good description.
Well, I mean, I would amend that a little bit by saying it's a refugee story, and I'm a refugee and not an immigrant. I think it's a really important distinction to draw, because immigrants serve the purposes of the American dream, and refugees oftentimes prove the existence of the American nightmare.
And yours was a nightmare story, your personal story?
Somewhat. I mean, I probably differ from a lot of Vietnamese Americans who have come here and who are very patriotic Americans. Instead, I sort of view the American intervention in Vietnam as an occupation, as a mistake. And it was a very unfortunate event that killed a whole lot of people, not just Americans, but 3 million Vietnamese and 3 million Laotians and Cambodians. So that's one of the key reasons why we have over a million Vietnamese here in the United States, because of that American occupation.
Well, you're right. There is a great deal of patriotism among many of those Vietnamese who are here, as opposed to criticism or as opposed to feeling that Vietnam was even a mistake or let alone a catastrophe. It's ironic, though, because you've said things to the effect of I think at one point you said, I have something to offend everyone, and particularly people of that brand of thinking. I mean, in the sense that you've also done some exposure along the lines of things that maybe they say that they wouldn't say openly.
Yeah. I mean, in public, Vietnamese Americans are very conciliatory with Americans. They feel indebted and they feel they have to perform a certain kind of gratitude in public to Americans. But behind closed doors, they will actually give vent to some of their bitterness and some of their anger about feeling betrayed by Americans, the promise that Americans would come and rescue them in their time of need that Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon made during the peace negotiations of 1973 were never realized. And the South Vietnamese were depending on that promise. And this is something that, again, the Vietnamese Americans don't like to bring out in public because they feel as if they're guests here in this country.
Well, it's no surprise to my listeners or mystery that I was a strong opponent of the Vietnam War and really could never figure out to a great degree why we went in there in the first place. I guess it had to do with dominoes and communism and American military strength and all of those kinds of things. But you feel, and you've said this publicly, that the sense of that war hasn't really ended, that it's continued and that in some ways it's almost embedded in what we did in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah. I mean, I'm deeply interested in the Vietnam War in and of itself because that history shaped me and made me who I am. But as a scholar and as a writer and as a thinker, the Vietnam War becomes important because it's only an episode in a long history of American expansion overseas that began in 1898 when the United States took the Philippines, Guam, Puerto Rico, Hawaii, Cuba, and extended their involvement in the Pacific through World War II, the Korean War, the Vietnam War into Laos and Cambodia. And Iraq and Afghanistan are really just an extension of this campaign, which I think of as a very long American war that's lasted for over a century.
See, I would, I guess, quarrel with you on that because I think Iraq was just stupid, weapons of mass destruction that didn't exist and everything. But Afghanistan was set off by the Taliban and set off by 9/11 and had certainly a lot to do with the fact that Afghanistan, at least under the Taliban, was giving sanctuary to Osama bin Laden and company. It's a different kind of war, really.
They're all very different kinds of wars with different kinds of triggers and causes and politics and circumstances. But the United States was also prepared to go into Afghanistan because it's spent a century building up a military industrial complex, setting up 800 military bases overseas, been interested in expanding American influence and power. So, yes, we were in Afghanistan for certain kinds of reasons due to American self-interest, but it also fit the larger agenda of American expansion, too.
Well, you've already exposed yourself as a politically minded writer, which can't be avoided in your work either, even though you present us with a communist sympathizer and present us with someone probably, I would imagine, of a different mind than yours, someone who really has two minds going operating at the same time. And I want to talk about this perspective. I know Ralph Ellison has been a major influence. In fact, you name your son Ellison. And there's a tone in the beginning, and a number of people have pointed out, that sounds like Invisible Man. There's a sense that Ralph Ellison wanted to move away from polemics. You know, this was a time when African-American writers were saying, particularly people like Richard Rider or Mary Baraka, you know, you have to really embed the politics in the narratives. Where do you stand on that?
Well,
because Ellison did not go along with them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, I'm a student of African-American literature. I understand the polarities and the arguments and everything, the seeming contrast between Richard Wright, Ralph Ellison, and so on. And Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, along with Native Son, were really important works for me, and I studied the both of them very closely. Now, my book, does definitely evoke and have a conversation with Invisible Man, but it departs from Invisible Man in a very key way, which is, I think, one of the reasons why Ellison became popular in the 1950s was because, you know, he depicted African-American engagement with radical politics, communism, the Brotherhood in his novel. But at the end, he also said, this is not a good thing. You know, this kind of ideology is eviscerating for the individual. And his form of hope at the end of that novel was to turn back to the individual. And this fit perfectly in with liberal anti-communism of the United States in the 1950s. And I knew that in writing my novel about a communist spy, the easiest way for me to write this book would be for the spy to renounce communism at the end and embrace American individualism. This is how one gets published in the American literary industry. And I refused to do that. So the end of the novel is actually, there's a very serious critique of communism at the end of this book. But my narrator doesn't simply say, hello, America. He returns to the possibility of revolution and collectivity and solidarity.
I also remember Ellison once saying in an interview, if I wanted to be a sociologist, I wouldn't be writing novels. Or if I wanted to be a politician, I wouldn't be writing novels, or words to that effect. But you're touching on something that I know is very important to you. I mean, because you've taken a strong stand on this. If you wanted to write like a majority writer, you would write a very different type of novel.
Yeah, I would write an apologetic novel. I'd write a novel that would accommodate, that would translate, that would make white people feel good about themselves by, again, affirming the American dream, having my narrator leave Vietnam and go to America only. At the end of the novel, a lot of people assume that, okay, so in the novel, he goes from Vietnam to America and then he goes back to Vietnam. And then at the end of the novel, he leaves again. I don't say where he goes, but most people assume he goes to America. It's not true. It's simply because the narrative of the American dream is so embedded in the American consciousness that people here can't even imagine that there's another destination for people fleeing from communist countries than the United States.
Somebody might say to you, look, your parents worked very hard in San Jose. They had a store, and I know they put their whole hearts and souls into it. Sent you and your siblings to college. Imagine sibling also has had success. You have a Pulitzer Prize. I mean, this is the American dream, isn't it?
Absolutely. And that's the sort of the contradiction. America creates a space for that kind of possibility. And there's a reason why the American dream persists. I talk about the American dream and the American nightmare simultaneously because they're part of the same reality. It's the President Obama narrative. You know, President Obama, I admire President Obama domestically for what he's done. But President Obama also extends American power overseas through drone strikes, et cetera, et cetera. So these are two parts of the same reality, and we have to be able to think about both of them at the same time.
You got kind of a binary mind in many ways. I mean, there's so much of your work that really is split and divided. And in fact, I think it was Faulkner who said in his Nobel speech, great art comes from the heart divided against itself. And you bring this division forward in many ways. And you talked about refugee before. You wanted to put a lot of emphasis on being a refugee rather than an immigrant. There is a sense of you're being connected to, well, the emotions of this spy. I think you've said that, in fact, in public interviews, haven't you?
Yeah, I mean, the spy is his own character. I mean, I'm not that spy. But in one level, emotionally, I share a lot with the spy because I grew up as a refugee in San Jose in the 1970s and 1980s. And I always, no matter where I was, I didn't feel at home. In my parents' home, I felt like an American spying on them and their strange customs. Outside of the house, I felt like a Vietnamese spying on a diversity of Americans and their strange customs. And that sense of always being displaced, always being in transit, always being in between has stayed with me. And that's, you know, that sense of duality, of always hiding something, of always observing people and not when they don't know that I'm observing them, that's part of what a spy does. So all I had to do was take my own personal circumstances as a refugee and exaggerate them in order to have a spy.
Well, you talked about being a kid and being introduced to chopsticks and feeling kind of strange, but also there was a kind of an aha moment for you when you went to see Apocalypse Now, right?
Well, those are two formative moments. When I first came to the United States, it was to Fort Indiantown Gap, Pennsylvania. That was one of the four refugee camps that Vietnamese people had to be processed through. In order to leave the camp, you had to have a sponsor. No sponsor would take my entire family. So at 4 years old, I was taken from my parents and sent to live with a white family. And I remember they were very well-meaning people, but one of the first things they did to me was give me a pair of chopsticks and say, hey, can you teach us how to use chopsticks? I was completely befuddled. I had no idea. I felt so bad. That was a moment of split identification. Then a little bit later, 10 years old, saw Apocalypse Now, much too young of an age, cheering for the American soldiers as a good American boy up until the moment they killed Vietnamese people. I was like, where am I supposed to be in this film? A terrible moment of split identification.
We're talking with Viet Thanh Nguyen, and his novel is A Sympathizer, which recently won the 2016 Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. He's also Associate Professor of English and American Studies and Ethnicity at USC and the author of Race and Resistance. And he'll be speaking at UC Berkeley, 315 Wheeler Hall, tonight. That is May 15th at 7 p.m. And you know, a writer I know you're probably familiar with, one of the great writers of Vietnam from the American perspective, Tim O'Brien, The Things They Carried. I was reading an essay about O'Brien, and essentially a guy was taking the position, he had been in Vietnam, and he said, the Vietnamese don't see O'Brien the way Americans see them. And in fact, they see his fiction as being something completely different. They're interested in kind of the surreal qualities of his fiction as opposed to all the war, because, you know, they certainly experience the war. And I think Philip Caputo said something about your work, who's also a really fine writer about Vietnam, American perspective, that your work is a totally different perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. And then The Guardian did a review recently where they said this is the anti The Things They Carried, my particular novel. And I think it's true. I mean, look, in my book Nothing Ever Dies, which just came out, I have a section on Tim O'Brien, on his thinking about true war stories, which is, you know, in The Things They Carried, he talks about what constitutes a true war story. It's a very moving and powerful set of ideas that he has. But I depart from him because I say the two things that Tim O'Brien doesn't bring up about what makes a true war story. One, true war stories are boring. And number two, true war stories what makes war compelling is that it's profitable. He never brings that up. So these are two of the reasons why we keep going to war. It makes money for somebody, and it's boring. We can pretend that it's not happening. That's why we're still engaged in these low-level wars that have been going on for like the last 15 years.
Well, there is a moment I remember in The Things They Carry where there's a Vietnamese soldier who dies, and he's a kid. I mean, he's like 15 years old. And as opposed to carrying all these things that these American soldiers carry, all these goods and wares of one sort or another, it's almost nothing that he's carrying. I mean, so O'Brien, you know, did extend himself in a moment like that, it seemed to me.
Oh, absolutely. And I think there's this empathy for the Vietnamese soldier and the Vietnamese other that's in Tim O'Brien's work, from going after Cacciato to The Things They Carried, that are very powerful and that distinguishes him from other American writers. I appreciate that in his work.
Let me ask you, perhaps, if you'd be kind enough to read something from The Sympathizer, just to give folks a sense of just how fluent your prose is and what you've done with this narrative.
Sure. This is the opening of the book. I'm a spy, a sleeper, a spook, a man of two faces. Perhaps not surprisingly, I'm also a man of two minds. I'm not some misunderstood mutant from a comic book or horror movie, although some have treated me as such. I'm simply able to see any issue from both sides. Sometimes I flatter myself that this is a talent. And although it is admittedly one of a minor nature, it is perhaps also the sole talent I possess. At other times, when I reflect on how I cannot help but observe the world in such a fashion, I wonder if what I have should even be called talent. After all, a talent is something you use, not something that uses you. The talent you cannot not use, the talent that possesses you, that is a hazard, I must confess. But in the month when this confession begins, my way of seeing the world still seemed more of a virtue than a danger, which is how some dangers first appear.
Yeah, it's a very strong opening, and we should mention it is a confession that we're hearing here.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a confession from our narrator to someone who we eventually discover to be the commandant of a communist re-education camp. So I chose this format because the confession is a literary form and a political form, and it was widely used in re-education camps in China and in Vietnam. But it's also important as a form because it allows a conversation between two Vietnamese people. And this means that I don't have to translate anything about Vietnam, because Vietnamese people, if they're having a conversation, don't translate their own culture to each other. But instead, what happens is I have to translate American culture, because I have a guy who's lived in America for a long time speaking to a communist who's never been to America. And so this allows me to satirize American culture and to talk about American culture in a way that many Americans have not thought about before.
You familiar with a Chinese writer named Hai Jin?
Yes.
I mean, because you get from his work so much of, well, I guess I can describe it as the horror of living under a communist regime, even after the Cultural Revolution. But in many respects, reading your work almost seems in some ways, not necessarily idealizing, that would be too strong, but certainly much more positively disposed.
Well, I mean, the last quarter of the novel has extreme...
Notwithstanding that.
Well, I mean, but that's really important.
Yeah. I didn't want to give away too much.
I don't want to give away too much either, but I mean... Look, when I said this book has something to offend everyone, the point is that if you read the first two-thirds to three-quarters of the book and you're South Vietnamese or an American patriot, you'd be like, oh my God, this guy's anti-American, he's a communist, because he seems to be pro-communist, you know? Well, you got to finish the book in order to see what I have to say about communism.
We're talking again with Viet Thanh Nguyen, who calls himself an anthropologist of Vietnamese and American culture and actually teaches American culture and American literature down at USC and has written a Pulitzer Prize-winning novel. A lot of people, when they think of Vietnamese coming here, they think of the boat people, of course, but they also think of people who, and I suppose this instills some of the sense of an American dream, who manage to adapt in ways that are almost miraculous. You know, you hear these stories in their legion, a number of somebody who came here from Vietnam who didn't speak a word of English and then became valedictorian of the class.
That was my brother.
All right, there you go. I mean, some people, you say, what is it, in the tea? You know, what are we talking about here? What makes them that way? But it's a striving, and it's an ethos, and it is tied a lot to Vietnamese culture.
Well, I think we have to be careful there. I think that these stories are true. I mean, it's true in my family and true for many people I know. But the 150,000 Vietnamese refugees who first came to the United States in 1975, a lot of them came from the political and military classes, which meant that they were already sociologically prepared to be a part of middle-class society. Many of them did actually speak some English and so on. And so this is the beginning of the model minority myth for Vietnamese Americans. If you go to Vietnam, there are a lot of stupid Vietnamese people there. There are a lot of Vietnamese people who don't do jack, you know. But those people don't get to go to the United States. Or they come later as the so-called boat people and so on. And, you know, there's a whole divide in the Vietnamese community between the very successful Vietnamese, which Americans obviously like to talk about because they affirm the American dream, and all those other Vietnamese living on welfare. And I know plenty of those people, too. We're very good at cheating welfare in Vietnamese-American culture. Maybe a lot of Vietnamese-Americans don't want me to hear you say that, but it's true.
It's always surprised me, though, to what extent the Vietnamese presently seem to be very welcoming to the United States. And look at, I suppose, capitalism and what America's succeeded in doing as far as a democracy operates as being something of a paradigm. I mean, I'm also interested in the fact that as you've pointed out on a couple of occasions, I believe that this is the first time perhaps the losers are writing history. The alleged losers are the ones who are writing history because Vietnam won the war, really.
Well, Vietnam won the war, but America won the war in memory globally. I mean, if you go to Vietnam, obviously you deal with Vietnamese stories, but outside you deal with American stories. You know, so I'm always having to talk about Apocalypse Now because it's the one thing people over the world know about in terms of the Vietnam War. Even when I go to Vietnam, there are some people who say, I love Apocalypse Now. So the point is that American culture, because it's so powerful, has been able to export its memories all over the world, and everybody has to contest with that. There's an inequality of memory. And that other issue about how Vietnam, many Vietnamese people in Vietnam are very welcoming to Americans, well, and seem to embrace capitalism, absolutely true. And part of the reason why is because for the Vietnamese people, the American War was simply an interruption in a much longer history of colonial struggle against China, France, and so on. The one thing I want to point out here, though, is that it's too easy to get into the narrative of reconciliation, to say Vietnam and America, we fought our war, now we can be friends again. Both the Vietnamese and Americans are interested in this narrative because it allows them to simplify history. Both Americans and Vietnamese forget that the so-called Vietnam War or American War was also fought in Laos and Cambodia, killed 3 million people there. Mm-hmm. Vietnamese people were also responsible for that. Vietnamese people don't want to remember that because they can't think of themselves as victims. They have to think of themselves as imperialists. And no one wants to think of themselves as imperialists, whether they're Americans or Vietnamese. So the Americans and the Vietnamese would rather forget all about that and focus on two former enemies making a new bond under capitalism and against China. That's the contemporary narrative of reconciliation today.
It's also very different, for example, than what you hear coming out of certain Latin American countries where the United States did not, I mean, they certainly played a very strong role with a strong hand, to put it mildly. But they did far worse things in Vietnam, and yet the anger is just not there like it is in some Latin American countries in Vietnam, or so it would seem.
I think that's really interesting, and I think it does have to do a lot with the fact that there was already a long history of struggle, again, against the French, Japanese, and the Chinese, especially the Chinese. So the fact that there's a bigger, badder enemy north of the border in Vietnam helps the Vietnamese people to get over what happened over a 30-year span with the Americans. And the fact that, you know, American capitalism, an American political military alliance has positive benefits for the Vietnamese against the Chinese.
So you got a sequel in the works already to this novel?
Yeah, I sold the sequel to my publisher, written the first 50 pages of the sequel, and he doesn't go to America. He goes to, you know, Paris.
Okay. Well, have you spent much time in Paris?
Lived there for about a year.
Oh, okay. We're talking again, if you just joined us, with Viet Thanh Nguyen. And let me open the phone lines. We're talking about his novel, obviously, The Sympathizer, which won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction, but also talking about Vietnam and, well, United States attitudes that continue about the war and Vietnamese attitudes that continue about the war. I think it's fairly safe to say that they are very different and still in many ways diametrically opposed. But we've raised a lot of questions here, and I'm particularly interested in hearing what some of our listeners who come from a Vietnamese background may want to say. And you are welcome to join us. In fact, let me give you the toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. You can join us now. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786. Or you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. We do invite you to join the program and welcome your calls, emails, and postings. And I should mention that our guest, Viet Thanh Nguyen, will be speaking at UC Berkeley at 315 Wheeler Hall. That's tonight at 7 p.m. But in the meantime, you are welcome to join the conversation. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour with Viet Thanh Nguyen, who's here with us in studio, who's the author of a debut novel, The Sympathizer, which won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction in April. Talking about the award, his life as a refugee, the role of marginalization and resistance, because they play a major role in his work. And again, he'll be at UC Berkeley, 315 Wheeler Hall tonight at 7 o'clock p.m. And we do invite your participation in the program. It's a live and interactive program. Welcome your calls. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. Or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and particularly be interested in hearing from some refugees and some thoughts about essentially what what Viet Thanh Nguyen has put on the record here, and we do welcome, as I said, your involvement in the program. I'm just going to ask quickly about your other book, though, Nobody Ever Dies, which is subtitled Vietnam and the Memory of War, and what are you trying to do in that book?
Well, Nothing Ever Dies. I think of that book and the novel The Sympathizer as the nonfiction and fiction bookends of the same project, which is thinking about war and memory, about why we go to war, why, how difficult it is for us to confront the inhumanity that is within our humanity, and then how we get to peace, reconciliation, justice, these really difficult questions that anybody who's lived through a war struggles with.
You know, it's a cliche, but war is hell. But the problem is that, as your title suggests, doesn't go away. I mean, the yeah. wounds and essentially the aftermath and the consequences simply keep on.
Yeah, I mean, this Vietnam War ended in 1975 officially, but for everybody who lived through it, for most people, it's not over, whether we're talking about Americans or Vietnamese. And although war is hell, I mean, we say that all the time, and yet we still keep on fighting wars. And I think the reason why, two reasons. One is that war is actually not hell. War is actually, like I said, boring. It's quotidian. We pay our taxes. We don't actually get drafted. We don't fight, and the war machine rolls on. And the other reason that war goes on is, again, we think of ourselves as human. We think of the other side as inhuman. And we think that our wars are justified and their wars are not. And so we're always tempted to go back and fight wars because we can't possibly do wrong.
A lot of what comes out in things you say and in your work is the need to feel the other perspective of the other, particularly the other who is marginalized or who is simply, I use Ralph Ellison's metaphor again, invisible.
Yeah, we do need to feel for the other. We do need to sympathize for the other and see from the other's perspective. But the flip side of that is those of us who are classified as other, like myself, the temptation is to imagine ourselves as victims. And that's a trap, too. And this is what happens with the South Vietnamese American community. They think of themselves as victims. They think of themselves as, and it's true, they are victims, but they're more than that. They've also been victimizers. They have a complex history in relationship to the war, and it's very difficult for people to confront the complexity of that history when they're tempted to see themselves only as victims.
Well, let's see what our listeners are here, what our listeners have to say, and I'm going to begin with you, Adele. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, Viet. Love your book. I'm half Vietnamese, and the main character is half Vietnamese as well, and I was wondering if you could comment on that.
Yeah, thank you. It was important for me to actually make the main character half Vietnamese and half French because, you know, this Eurasian perspective and later the Amerasian perspective has often been overlooked in Vietnamese culture and American culture, French culture, because these are all racist cultures and they don't know what to do with mixed race people. So it's important to foreground that point of view. But then also, of course, it allows me to do all kinds of things dramatically and symbolically around the question of being divided between cultures, divided between races, and working through that old tired idea that East is East and West is West and never the twain shall meet.
Let me thank the caller and go right to another caller. That's you, Neil. Neil likes to talk about Graham Greene. Actually, there are echoes of Graham Greene in this novel. Neil, you'll
yes,
be happy to know.
Not having read any of your works, I don't know exactly what your opinion was of Graham Greene or of either of the film versions of The Quiet American, the first being by far the better of the two. Any comments you might have would be appreciated.
Well, I read The Quiet American when I was in college, and I wrote an entire thesis on the Orientalist themes of The Quiet American. And so I recognize that it's a very important book historically and politically, but it's also a book that perhaps unintentionally exemplifies many of these Orientalist ideas of who the Vietnamese people are and the role of the West in terms of rescuing the Vietnamese. And Greene is obviously very critical of that. He has a critical take on the American view, but at the same time, I think he also sort of implicitly endorses that kind of superiority. And so this book, this novel has echoes of the Quiet American narrative, but it's also a takedown of many of the assumptions in The Quiet American as well. So far as the two movies go, I think one of the ironies is that Hollywood really screwed Graham Greene over with that first 1950s version because it was a very beautiful movie, but then at the end, it shows the Fowler, the English journalist, who in the novel is extremely critical of the United States, in the end confessing his remorse over what he's done. And taking the blame for himself. And so this was Hollywood's way of, stabbing Graham Greene in the back.
Let me thank the caller and go to some of your comments here. Maria writes, I don't know a single American who thinks the Vietnam War was a good thing. There's a new documentary about the fall of Saigon and how the American soldiers were trying to take as many South Vietnamese to America with them as possible as the North Vietnamese were approaching. Congress in the United States didn't give them the helicopters they needed, and many Vietnamese were left behind, but it wasn't the individual soldiers who betrayed them. It was the body of Congress that was responsible for leaving them behind. Heartbreaking.
Well, that's true. The documentary she was referring to is Rory Kennedy's Last Days in Vietnam. And
it's which we featured on Forum. I was not here that day.
Right. But, yeah. So it's absolutely true. And of course, like I said, the promises were made to the South Vietnamese government that the Americans would be there for them even after the American forces withdrew. And that didn't happen. The South Vietnamese military was using American weapons and airplanes and all that other kind of stuff. They were fighting a war that had been dictated to them by the American military, fighting an American-style war. And then the American military and the government pulled the rug out from under them by not giving them the ammunition and the gas to use these American weapons. And so there was a real sense of betrayal. And, of course, there was no evacuation plan. The Americans knew that that South Vietnam was going to fall. They had months to think about this, and they refused to implement an evacuation plan that would have evacuated at least 1 million or more South Vietnamese who were allied with them in some kind of very substantive way, and only 150,000 South Vietnamese managed to get out in the final hours.
Fair to say that you were radicalized at Berkeley, or was it before that?
No, I was radicalized at Berkeley. Berkeley is my alma mater. It's the school that made me. I remember going there and feeling I'm at home. This was the place where I needed to be, and being struck by intellectual lightning in the classes that I took in ethnic studies and Asian American studies, and I've never forgotten that spark that has led eventually to these books.
Here's a comment from Stacy. Actually, it's a question. She says, I'm ashamed to admit that I don't know much about the history of the Vietnam War. Do you have any good recommendations of books to learn more?
Well, I mean, there's so many. You could start with my books.
I was going to suggest it. You modestly did so, but actually you do learn a lot about the war from your book. Yeah.
Well, I think there are other books that you can obviously read, of course. You know, Frederick Loggeville wrote a Pulitzer Prize-winning history about the Vietnam War just a few years ago, and there's plenty of works out there. And obviously the American take on the war is exemplified by things like Tim O'Brien. I would also say, you know, read Larry Heineman's Close Quarters if you want the American point of view, because that's a novel that I read when I was 12 or so, and I hated this book. Because Heineman, what he does is he shows a young American soldier who goes to Vietnam. He's a nice guy, and then he becomes a killer and a rapist. And he doesn't editorialize. He doesn't say this is wrong. And at 12 years old, I didn't know how to handle that. But as an adult writer, I went back and looked in his book, and I thought, that's the right thing to do. If you're going to talk about atrocity, give it to the reader. Don't give the reader a way out. And that's what I do in this book, and that's why some readers find themselves uncomfortable with the fact that they have to be forced to confront terrible things and they're not told what to think about them. But in terms of my own two books, I've read an enormous number of American books about this war, and I find that they all lack, or most of them lack, any serious understanding of the Vietnamese perspectives of all kinds. And so that's what I try to do, is to provide a very different point of view on what the Vietnam War means to Americans and to Vietnamese people.
I know there were turning points, because this was the first war to some extent that was televised. And, you know, the woman fleeing from napalm, the child really fleeing from napalm, the My Lai massacre, and also General Key performing that execution. Those were really, I mean, they were extraordinary in what they represented about the power of images.
No, absolutely. And I'm both thankful and regretful for that, because of the power of those images, the Vietnam War will never be forgotten. People have a half a dozen images from that war. Everybody has seen these kinds of pictures, and that's what they think of about the Vietnam War. The drawback of that is that that's what they think about the Vietnam War. That's all they know.
It's limited.
It's very limited. Yeah. And when they think of Vietnam, they think war. Or when they think Vietnamese people, they think victims. And Vietnam is not a war. It's a country. And Vietnamese people are not just victims. We're complex human beings, and we're capable of doing terrible things. And again, that temptation to think of Vietnamese people as victims leads to a certain kind of condescension in the American mind towards Vietnamese people. And it tempts Vietnamese people to think of themselves in a simplistic fashion.
Talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist and actually writer of nonfiction, Viet Thanh Nguyen, whose book is The Sympathizer, which just won the Pulitzer Prize last month. Also, since you mentioned Berkeley, you've talked about the importance of ethnic studies. Now you're teaching a lot of ethnic literature and so forth. There's right now, as we speak, a hunger strike going on. You may be aware of at San Francisco State University, where I teach. Students want $8 million for ethnic studies, and I'd like to get your thoughts on this, particularly in terms of there was a big strike at San Francisco State before I came to teach there, and it was a strike that was led by black students mainly over ethnic studies, over not enough black professors and not enough black literature. And then they had an ethnic studies under Jim Hirabayashi for years, and there's a lot of complaints about the enrollments plummeting. Now, I don't know that that's necessarily the case all across the country, but certainly ethnic studies programs have a lot of controversy. And there's a study that just came out of Stanford, I should get this in, that says that they are tremendous help to students, actually. I mean, the studies were pretty quantified. What's your feeling about, you know, ethnic studies just in general? And should students have, should $8 million of much-needed revenue be invested in an ethnic studies program?
Well, I think the strike you're referring to was the Third World Strike of 1968, 1969,
right?
And obviously black students played a major role in that, but also other students as well, you know, Asian American students, Chicano students, Native Americans. And part of the power of that moment was that it wasn't only one group. It was the Third World in the United States organizing and connecting what was happening domestically in the U.S.
It's a good point because it was identified largely with black students.
Right. But this was the beginning of the Asian American movement, for example. So, you know, I think obviously people look at this and they look at this in two extremes. The one extreme is, hey, this is bad. We don't want ethnic studies on campus because it's going to radicalize people and we don't want more leftists coming out of Berkeley and SF State and all that kind of stuff. The other side, the other extreme is, hey, we need this because it's an antidote to the temptation to pacify students in college and to treat college as a preparatory school for a job. And obviously, I endorse the view that what we do in the humanities in general, but ethnic studies in particular, is that our function is not simply to produce worker drones. Our function is to produce thinkers, to produce intellectuals. And I'm not talking about becoming a professor. I'm just saying in your everyday life, it doesn't matter if you're a mechanic or a millionaire, you can be a drone, but you can also be a thinker. And that's what you're supposed to get in college. And ethnic studies is simply one function of that. So the struggle over ethnic studies at SF State, for example, it's indicative of the larger crisis in terms of how the humanities has been underfunded, deprivileged, submerged under the impetus to just get students ready for jobs.
Comment from a listener, Eve, who writes on our Facebook page, I'm really looking forward to reading this book and more by this author. And particularly, I appreciate his articulation of ideas about war that we don't often hear. Interesting coincidence. I saw the film Eye in the Sky last night. It's a good film, by the way. I saw it, too. And it occurred to me that the real war is against the attitude that, however regrettable, innocents always have to die when the cause is just. Now, Eye in the Sky is really about drone warfare and the use of drone warfare and collateral damage and all of that sort of thing. And, you know, there's a lot of collateral damage in the Vietnam War. In fact, that's, I think, when those words crept into our lexicon big time.
Well, yeah, and that's why I think that we have to understand what's happening today as part of the same continuum of history as what happened in the Vietnam War, because the drone strikes and the drone technology is a direct outcome technologically of what was being developed in the Vietnam War, but also politically. It was bad news in the Vietnam War that the U.S. dropped enormous numbers of bombs all over Southeast Asia, mass carpet bombing, you know, more bombs on Southeast Asia than all of Europe during World War II. And in order to counteract the negative political consequences of that, we developed drone strikes. So now we think that carrying out so-called pinpoint drone strikes is better politically than mass bombing countries. And it's arguably the case that that's still not true. It doesn't matter to a certain extent whether you kill a million civilians or whether you kill 100 civilians. The civilians who are witnessing that, you know, who know that a lot of these people are innocent, are going to get really, really upset. You know, and so the idea that drones and bombs are going to save us Americans from the long-term consequences of perpetual warfare is, I think, a fallacy.
I think Obama bought into that for a while, but then began to back away from it, or so it would seem. But we're still using drone warfare, and argue. I mean, here again, you get into this divided argument that's so at the heart of your novel. You can hear. We try to do this all the time on this radio program. You know, hearing both sides, I've heard people argue eloquently for the need to use drones because of the volatile nature of the Middle East and, you know, helping causes of one sort or another. And then, you know, you hear the arguments more from the side, I think, that you and I are probably more sympathetic with. Here's Harry who tweets, Senator John McCain is frequently referred to as a hero for having been a 7-year prisoner of war in North Vietnam. You see him as a hero?
Well, let me just say that the Vietnamese saw him as what they called an air pirate, right? That obviously from the American point of view, you know, these young men who are flying A4 bombers and whatever, and bombing North Vietnam were risking their lives, and they were heroes in that sense. But there are two sides to every war. And for the North Vietnamese who were on the receiving side of these bombs, they didn't see them as heroes because these bombs were oftentimes landing on hospitals and schools and dams and farms and dikes and all these other kinds of things. I mean, just imagine if Russians were coming over to bomb us. Actually, we don't have to imagine. We got bombed in 9/11, right? We don't think of those people as heroes. We think of them as villains.
But when you say there's two sides to every war, and I'm thinking about a novel like Slaughterhouse-Five by Kurt Vonnegut, you know, he almost makes it seem that he puts the human dimension into the bombing of Dresden in that novel. That's really what it's all about. Nevertheless, it's tough for some people to think, well, there are two sides where the Nazis are concerned, or there are two sides where, you know, some of these where ISIS is concerned.
Yeah, I think it's tempting to paint the picture of our enemies as extremists and as people who are monsters and that are somehow beyond human comprehension. And it's just a sort of a continuum. We do that on a small scale, whether it's Native Americans who are the evil villains that we have to wipe out, or whether it's ISIS, or whether it's Al-Qaeda, or whether it's the Nazis and so on. And that just sort of misunderstands how warfare operates and how inhumanity operates. You know, I mean, we're again, the temptation is to think of our side as human. Drone strikes are a humane policy. We're only killing 1,000 people versus 1,000,000. The other side thinks it doesn't matter whether you're killing 1,000 people or 1,000,000. You're killing innocent people, and the policies are unjustified. And so, likewise,
but when you have the hegemon, when you have one group, for example, that's totally oppressing another group, and it may be the people in power largely, but what do you do? I mean, as much as you may hate warfare, you know, ISIS are taking American journalists and cutting their heads off, literally, mm-hmm. and, you know, raping young girls and putting them into sexual slavery. I mean, horrible things that we read about and that are documented and that are real.
Yeah. And I think what needs to be understood is that, again, you need the larger frame. Because if you think only of the conflict, the specific conflict, then you have a set of limited options. People are attacking us. We have to attack them back. Okay, possibly the case. But how did these conditions arise in the first place? How have we set up a situation in which ISIS can possibly exist? How far back do we go in terms of understanding the history that has produced it? Do we go back to American intervention? Do we go back to British colonization and the division of the Middle East and the various kinds of countries that didn't exist in the first place? I mean, we have to take a long view historically in order to prevent future conflicts from happening. The belief that we can take a short-term view and simply bomb everybody that we think of as our enemies isn't going to solve
long
the problem.
View, though, may keep you from doing what you need to do militarily or in terms mm-hmm. of defense or what might be necessary and valuable aggression.
Well, I think that in the United States and in England and in France, there's only the short view. So that's fine, but where's the long view? When do we get to talk about the long view, about the long-term way to address these deep divisive issues that stem from European colonialism?
Let me bring another caller in, and this is a Berkeley caller. Trum, morning. You're on the air.
Hi. My name is Trum, and I'm
sorry, your phone is beeping in some strange way. We're going to have to ask you to call back if you could. I don't know what was going on there, but we'll go on to another caller. Charles, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi. I'm really excited to read your book, first of all. Again, my name is Charles. I go to Vietnam often. My question was about the Vietnamese American things that I've noticed in the culture from the Vietnamese American culture here. So my ex-girlfriend was Vietnamese Australian, a pianist, and she played in a lot of great concerts with Vietnamese philharmonics. And I noticed that a lot of times they threw South Vietnamese flags, and it seemed to really bipolarize people and audience members alike. The older generation was very proud of that flag. The younger generation seemed to be very disconnected with it. And I noticed that a lot of times, a few times, some friends actually had immigration problems after being associated either in photographs or with organizations that commonly flew the South Vietnamese flag here. I'm just curious to know, there was such a huge disconnect between the young and the old with that flag. Like, how do you think that it's going to end? Is that going to fizzle out? Is it something that's going to change? Like, I don't know. If you have any comments on that, it'd be very interesting to hear.
Yeah, well, the South Vietnamese flag, the flag of the that regime, still holds a lot of symbolic importance in the Vietnamese diaspora of a few million people, especially here in California. I think it's even been declared the heritage and freedom flag of the Vietnamese-American community by the California legislature. And that is a kind of politics driven by the older generation who, you know, fought the war and lost their country.
You're in L.A. You see it flying all the time in Little Saigon.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think here in Northern California, too, wherever there's a large congregation of Vietnamese-Americans, they would never fly the current flag, the red star, the red flag with the yellow star. As if you flew that, you would be driven out of the community. But I think that the younger Vietnamese American generations, there is some disconnect with that, but also a significant number of them do feel obligated to that flag because they feel obligated to their parents. They have a lot of filial piety, and they feel they need to carry the burden of their parents' memories. So it's a very still a very conflicted history, and it obviously speaks to the sometimes tense relationships between the Vietnamese diaspora and the current Vietnamese government, so that there are, you know, South Vietnamese patriots overseas who, if they were to go back and say some of the things that they say over here, you know, they would be thrown in jail. It's happened because of political actions that they've undertaken. But the younger Vietnamese American generation tends to be just much more pragmatic. I've known so many younger Vietnamese Americans who've gone to Vietnam or gone back to Vietnam because they want to make money, or they want to discover their culture, or they want to find opportunities that aren't available to them to here in the United States because of racism, basically.
Let me thank Charles for the call. And Vin is next. Vin, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Hi, I would like to hear your thought on the Vietnamese-American community, general conservatism and xenophobic, especially toward the Syrian refugee, especially the refugee crisis going on right now in Syria, considering the fact that we just very recently we were in the same situation as they are. But I noticed that whenever there's a community organization rally, we don't really support them as much, and rather we still look at them as in kind of like a very xenophobic lens. What can we do to help them?
Yeah, you know, unfortunately, Vietnamese Americans, there are a lot of racists, a lot of racism in the Vietnamese American community directed at all kinds of populations. I heard all kinds of stuff when I was growing up. It's really unfortunate. And it's really unfortunate because, you know, as Vietnamese refugees, we benefited from a certain moment of hospitality in American culture. Despite all the various complicated politics that we've been talking about, it is good that the American government accepted 150,000 Vietnamese refugees in their time of need, and other Southeast Asian refugees too. And that over the course of the next couple of decades, the American this country accepted hundreds of thousands of so-called boat people and re-education camp prisoners and Amerasians and so on. So the American government has, and the American people have, felt a certain kind of obligation to the Vietnamese. And for those Vietnamese refugees who benefited from that, the logical conclusion is we should be helping other refugees who have their hour of need right now. But I think a certain segment of the Vietnamese American community doesn't feel that kinship. Instead, they think of themselves as the exceptional refugee, the exceptional immigrant, the ones who are good people who can assimilate into American society, and they accept the xenophobia that is unfortunately a trend amongst a certain portion of the American population that think that Middle Easterners and Muslims simply can't be assimilated into American society. That's really unfortunate, and I think the way we get around that is to continue to address it in public, to continue to address the racism and the xenophobia of the Vietnamese-American community, and encourage the Vietnamese-American community to remember their past and what was done for them.
Let me thank Vin for the call. Some of that fear, though, I mean, realistically speaking, again, there's been concern expressed in almost every community that Syrian refugees might be jihadists or linked to ISIS again.
Oh, I just point to Sam B's full frontal episode where she talks about that and talks about what kind of really minuscule proportion of people that could possibly even be a jihadist, and the fact that we're only accepting like 10,000 Syrian refugees. We are not a generous country at this point towards Syrian refugees. There's intense amounts of screening being done already. We could accept more. And I would just point out to the fact that when Vietnamese refugees first came to the United States, although the American government allowed that to happen, the majority of Americans did not want Vietnamese refugees. They were xenophobic. They were afraid that we couldn't assimilate.
And they were also afraid that they were communists, too.
Then they were afraid we were communists, you know. So it's just at every contemporary moment, it's easy to give in to fear, to hatred of the unknown. And we have to be better than that.
Here's Mojda. Mojda, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Hi. Thank you for this discussion. Oh, I think I have an echo. Do you hear an echo? Should I?
Yeah, no, we can hear you. Just speak okay. and ignore the echo.
Okay.
If thanks. You can.
Of course. So I wanted to say thank you for this this opportunity. You know, the talk is amazing. And I wanted to mention that this long view or long road is really, really important. I'm originally from Iran. I know that your listener have heard enough about the reason that this, situation with Iran exists and the root of it, which is the coup of 1953. But going forward, sort of trying to heal those wounds and going forward, I think as your guest eloquently put it, the long road is important. And in my view, it starts with kids. Teaching them how to coexist and how to learn history for what it is and not just for what, you know, we read today in the books. And the media, of course, has a big role in it, but literature, and I write myself as well, and I can tell you this literature is amazing, and what, you know, people like your guests are doing is very, very helpful, but we do have to start with kids, so something for kids. I think. What do you think about that?
Did you have a question, though, Moshe?
It was about kids.
Well, what is your view on how to
inspire children more or educate children more? Okay, I just want to get to the nub of it. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I'm a believer in education. I'm a believer in literature. I'm a believer in the arts. You know, what I say in Nothing Ever Dies is that one of the reasons why we fight wars is because we're committed to nationalism in the nation. And what writers and artists offer us is an imagination beyond the nation. And this is what happens in the humanities. This is what happens in ethnic studies. This is what happens in any kind of educational program, whether it's in college or all the way down to kindergarten. If we have a commitment to this idea that the imagination is important, we have to let it grow, and we have to look beyond borders and boundaries like the nation or like race, that's how we transform the next generation.
And we thank the caller, and we're pretty much at the end of the hour here. I wanted to again congratulate you on the Pulitzer Prize. This will change your life dramatically if it hasn't already begun. It's only been, less than a month now, right?
Thanks for this opportunity. It has been a transformation.
And good luck with ongoing work. Again, we've been talking with the author of The Sympathizer, and he will be appearing, Via 10 Nguyen will be appearing tonight at UC Berkeley, going back home in a way, 315 Wheeler Hall. That's at 7 p.m. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. You can continue discussing this online, kqed.org/forum. And behind the scenes here, Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg, Judy Campbell, and Susan Britton. Our engineer today is Howard Gelman. Our engagement producer, Amanda Stupai. And we get online support from Amanda Font. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. Executive producer, Joanne Wallace. Our interns are Eli Wolf and Ida Mojadad. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.